I think I'm going to start with a number. Those of you who like numbers, enjoy this number. It's very likely to be the only number I use in the entire day and a half. Those of you who don't like numbers, and I assume that's the communicators, endure this number and it will be all words from here on in. But this number captures, I think, the very essence of risk communication, so it's a convenient place to start. If you make a long list of hazards and you rank order them in order of something like expected annual mortality, how many people they kill in a good year, and then you take the same list of hazards and you rank order them in order of how upsetting they are to people, the correlation between the two rank orders is approximately 0.2. Now, those of you who have studied statistics may remember you can square a correlation coefficient to get the percentage of variance accounted for. If you square 0.2, you get 0.04, a glorious 4% of the variance. Or, and here it is without numbers, the risks that kill people and the risks that upset people are completely different. If you know a risk is deadly, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know a risk is upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's deadly. Now, I'm not suggesting that risks that are upsetting are almost always safe. That would be a negative correlation. And we don't have a negative correlation. We have a tiny positive correlation. To all intents and purposes, those two dimensions are completely unrelated. That 0.2 correlation is as close as we come in risk communication to a universal. If you replace mortality with morbidity in the calculation, you're not killing people anymore, you're hurting them or making them sick, and you correlate morbidity with public concern, you get 0.2. If you're worried, as many of you are, less about health than you are about ecosystem damage, and you correlate ecosystem damage with public concern, it again comes out 0.2. If you're not worried about any of that, you're worried about social impact, and you correlate social impacts with public concern about those social public impacts, you get 0.2. Okay? If you're not worried about any of that, and all you really care about is environmental impact, and you correlate environmental impact with public concern, it comes out 0.2. Doesn't seem to matter what your measure of harm is. Whatever your measure of harm, across a wide range of situations, the correlation between how much harm that situation is doing and how upset people are getting about the situation is this ridiculously low 0.2 correlation. And the key intellectual question in risk communication is, why is the correlation so low? And the key practical question in risk communication is, how do we get it higher? How do we get people more concerned when a risk is serious and less concerned when a risk is trivial? Now, back in the 1980s, trying to make sense out of this very low correlation, and I didn't do the research that found the correlation. The initial work was done by Richard Wilson at Harvard. It's been redone 4 or 5 times since, and it hasn't gotten any better. You know, it's still 0.2. But trying to make sense out of it back in the 1980s, I coined terminology that has become fairly standard in risk communication and very much standard for me. So I want to share that terminology with you. The terminology that I want to introduce to you starts with the word risk. Now, I suspect many of you know what risk means to risk assessors, but many of you probably don't, so let me define it for you quickly. Please don't write this down. I'm going to give you the definition, and then I'm going to trash the definition. What risk means to risk assessors is very straightforward. It's a multiplication of two things: magnitude, sometimes called consequence, how bad is it when it happens, times probability or frequency, how likely is it to happen. And you get your best measure of how bad it is, your best measure of how frequent it is, you multiply them by each other, and you come out with something like expected annual mortality. And you know you have a future in risk assessment if you can say expected annual mortality with a smile. Okay. I mean, they don't just expect it, they look forward to it. Okay. Now, sometimes that calculation of magnitude times probability is based on hard data. Automobile fatalities, for example, we can go out on the highway and count the bodies. Okay. But for most of the risks that generate controversy, and for most of the risks that Environment Protection Authority people and other EPAs around the country tend to focus on, the data are not usually hard. But whether the data are hard or soft, and it's worth remembering that the data are usually soft, but whether the data are hard or soft, what risk assessors mean by risk is this multiplication of magnitude times probability, which is really their guess at magnitude times their guess at probability. And then because they know they're guessing, there is in risk assessment a very well-established protocol that says, you know, it's much better, since you know you don't know much, since you know you're guessing, it's much better to overestimate a risk than it is to underestimate a risk. This is called conservativeness. So we put our thumb on the scale, and we consciously overestimate the risk so we can be pretty confident that we're not underestimating it. So it becomes the multiplication of our conservative guess at magnitude times our conservative guess at probability. But underneath the random error, which is the fact that we're guessing, and the systematic error, which is the policy of guessing conservatively, underneath all of that, what risk means to risk assessors is this multiplication of magnitude times probability. The core problem is that's not what anybody else means by risk. It's not even what risk assessors mean by risk when they go home at night. Okay. So let's redefine terms. Let's take what risk assessors mean by risk, the multiplication of magnitude times probability, and for the duration of this seminar, we're going to call that hazard. They have a different definition for hazard. Their definition for hazard is the thing that causes the risk. We're going to mess around with their definitions, and we're going to redefine as hazard the risk as risk assessors see it, the multiplication of magnitude times probability. And then let's take what normal people think of risk, and I'm going to take this concept apart in a few minutes, but for the moment, let's think of it as one thing and call it outrage, which leads to the only math I'm going to burden you with today, a new definition of risk, or new to many of you at least. I would suggest that properly considered, risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. Now, this is a redefinition that makes a difference, and I want to make sure everybody understands why. The way the problem is usually seen, and remember, the problem is this miserable 0.2 correlation between whether people are going to get hurt and whether people are going to get upset. The way that problem is usually seen is as a problem of public misperception. And so my clients spend a lot of time complaining that the public just doesn't get it, just doesn't understand, just doesn't perceive the risk correctly. What this redefinition does is suggest something very different and much more symmetrical. What I'm arguing is that the experts, when they look at a risk, focus on the hazard and ignore the outrage. The experts therefore systematically overestimate the risk when the hazard is high and the outrage is low. And the experts systematically underestimate the risk when the hazard is low and the outrage is high, because all they're doing is looking at the hazard. The public makes exactly the opposite mistake. The public focuses on the outrage and ignores the hazard. The public, therefore, overestimates the risk when the outrage is high and the hazard is low. And the public underestimates the risk when the outrage is low and the hazard is high. So let me make sure everybody gets it. Okay. Here's what I'm saying. If the hazard is high and the outrage is low, give me an example of a high hazard, low outrage risk, not in your work, but in your life. Driving a car. Okay. Especially driving a car while talking on your cell phone, or you know, driving a car while you've had too much to drink, but just plain old driving a car. you know, or driving a car without a seatbelt, but just plain old driving a car. Give me another high hazard, low outrage risk.
Sun exposure.
Yeah, we know, particularly in Australia, that the skin cancer risk is non-trivial. But, you know, in spite of considerable progress in Australia, most of us are still sun worshippers, and we can't imagine that that's going to do us harm until you get to be my age and you're pulling skin cancers out every couple of weeks. Eating too much, exercising too little, smoking, drinking. All the things that your spouse and your doctor give you a hard time about, these are the classic high hazard, low outrage risks. And what I'm suggesting with regard to the high hazard, low outrage risks is the experts are going to take them seriously, the public is going to shrug them off, and the experts will be tearing their hair out trying to figure out how to get this stupid public to realize that this is really dangerous. On the other side, we have the high outrage, low hazard risks, the risks that are very likely to upset people, but not very likely to kill people. And there the situation is exactly the reverse. The experts are going to shrug the risk off. The public is going to take the risk seriously, and the experts will still be tearing their hair out, trying to figure out how to get this stupid public to realize that this is no big deal. When the hazard is high and the outrage is also high, okay, and that happens, remember, it's essentially no correlation, so we've got all four quadrants well represented. When the hazard is high and the outrage is also high, the experts will take it seriously because it's high hazard. The public will take it seriously because it's high outrage. It's a coincidence. And as soon as they start talking to each other about it, they very quickly come to realize that they're not actually talking about the same thing at all. And finally, when the hazard is low and the outrage is also low, the experts shrug it off because it's low hazard. The public shrugs it off because it's low outrage. It's another coincidence. But you don't tend to talk to each other about a risk that neither of you considers serious. Okay, I said a few minutes ago that the only thing that hazard and outrage have in common is that they're both called risk by different groups of people. The experts say risk and they mean hazard. The public says risk and it means outrage. And when they talk to each other, not surprisingly, they are talking past each other. Okay. But there's something else that hazard and outrage have in common that goes to the core of what we're going to be working on today, and that is this. When outrage is high, perceived hazard will also be high. When outrage is low, perceived hazard will also be low. So if you think of this as a correlation matrix, the correlation between hazard and outrage, as I told you, is very low, 0.2. The correlation between hazard and hazard perception is similarly low. But the correlation between outrage and hazard perception is quite high. Those of you who want an extra number at no extra charge, it's about 0.7, okay, accounting for roughly half the variance. Okay. Well, whenever you have a correlation that high, 0.7 is a good high correlation. That's about the same as the correlation between two different IQ tests. So whenever you have a correlation that good, if you're any kind of scientist at all, the question you immediately ask is, what's the direction of the causality? Okay. And what that question means in this case is as follows. Are people upset because they think the situation is dangerous? Or do people think the situation is dangerous because they're upset? Now, that's an important question. If they're upset because they think it's dangerous, the solution, assuming you don't agree that it's dangerous, the solution is to convince them that it's not dangerous. If they think it's dangerous because they're upset, the solution is to stop upsetting them. If you want to manage the system, you need to understand its causal structure. You don't want to be in the embarrassing position of trying to manipulate the effect in order to influence the cause. That's not good engineering, it's not good science, and it's not good risk communication either. Okay. So there's been a lot of research on the causal relationship between outrage and hazard perception. Okay. I'm going to share the result of that research with you, but first, let me test your intuition. How many of you think that outrage causes hazard perception? People get upset for reasons we haven't talked about yet. And because they're upset, they think the situation is dangerous, whether it really is or not. How many of you think that hazard perception causes outrage? People think the situation is dangerous for reasons we haven't talked about yet. And because they think it's dangerous, they get upset. Some of you are voting twice. It turns out that the first group is right. The second group is also right, but much less right. In the research on this causal relationship, it's a cycle. There are arrows in both directions, but the arrow from outrage to hazard perception is very strong, very robust. And the arrow from hazard perception to outrage is surprisingly weak. It's there, but it's surprisingly weak. For the most part, it is not true that hazard perception causes outrage. It's much more true that outrage causes hazard perception. Okay. The same thing is true on the other side of the relationship. It is mostly not the case that people are calm because they think the situation isn't dangerous. It is much more the case that people think the situation isn't dangerous because they're calm. Outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage. And off in a corner, we have actual hazard, which isn't the engine of anything. Okay. Now, no one should get the impression I'm saying hazard isn't important. You know, as a regulator, regulating hazard is your way of saving lives, and I'm certainly not arguing that if you have a choice between killing people without upsetting them or upsetting people without killing them, you're better off killing them. That's not my argument. Okay. It is, however, my argument that whether you kill them or not has shockingly little to do with whether you upset them or not. Okay, but whether you upset them has a huge impact on whether they think you're killing them. Okay. This begins to make sense out of something that many of you have experienced. You go to a public meeting, and I'm going to make this a meeting about a factory, and I'm going to assume that the factory emits out of its stacks a compound called dimethyl meatloaf. Okay. And there's dimethyl meatloaf coming out of the stacks of that factory, and the people who live near the factory are very worried that dimethyl meatloaf is giving them cancer. They think they have a cancer cluster because of the dimethyl meatloaf emissions from the factory. Is this a familiar pattern, to all of you? Okay. And there you are, at the front of the room, or maybe there is some technical consultant that you have brought in as a third-party expert, and either your expert or the technical consultant's expert is standing in front of the room saying something like this: "We have done a quantitative risk assessment on the risk of the dimethyl meatloaf emissions from this factory stacks. And we have determined scientifically that the odds that anyone in this room will die as a result of this factory's dimethyl meatloaf emissions are less than 1 in 1,000,000. And you're booed. And someone stands up in the back of the room and says, "You're lying. We're all going to die of leukemia." And there's tumultuous applause. You've been to meetings like that, right? And you ask yourself, what does it take to applaud the idea that you're going to die of leukemia? Okay. And the answer is outrage. When people are outraged enough, they would rather believe they're going to die of leukemia than believe you're not the Antichrist after all. Okay. And under those circumstances, you're going to have a very difficult time convincing them that they're not going to die of leukemia. They want to die of leukemia. Okay. Or to make the point more carefully, they want to believe they're going to die of leukemia so they can hang on to their outrage at you. That's not because they're stupid. It's not because they never studied engineering or public health or environmental protection or of any of the other disciplines that you guys may have studied. It's certainly not because they're aboriginals or immigrants or members of some other ethnic group. It appears to be because they're human. In the research on the issues that I've been talking about, on the causal relationship between outrage and hazard perception, on people's inclination to hang on to their outrage-driven hazard perception in the face of evidence because they want to hang on to their outrage, that is universal. It is as characteristic of smart, well-educated university graduates as it is of people who are maybe not so smart and not so well-educated. Okay. The big difference, by the way, between highly educated people and less educated people is highly educated people, when their outrage drives them to reach a hazard perception that is in conflict with the data, will criticize the data. They'll say, well, yes, but there's this thing that's wrong with your study and this thing that's wrong with your study and this thing that's wrong with your study. They'll trash your study. And since studies are never perfect, they can always find things with which to trash your study. Less educated people don't know how to do that. They just don't believe your study, and they continue to say, I still think whatever it is that they thought before. You know, that's a distinction without a difference. They're both rejecting the data. They're both rejecting the data because of their outrage. Okay, so two things are true at this dimethyl meatloaf meeting. The first thing that's true is that when you tell a roomful of outraged people that dimethyl meatloaf doesn't cause leukemia, they resist that claim, they resist the data in support of that claim, they are attached to their conviction that dimethyl meatloaf does cause leukemia because they are attached to their outrage. Okay, and I hope you are, you know, as I say this, thinking about times when you have been outraged, and noticing that that's exactly how you are, that, you know, when you're angry at a store that has sold you a shoddy piece of merchandise, you become more attached to your anger than you do to their replacing the merchandise. And if they treat you decently, you look for ways to continue to be angry at them anyhow, because you want them to be the jerk that you have decided they are. The same thing happens between husband and wife. Hopefully this rings a bell. Okay, so the first thing that's true and that I've emphasized so far is that people will resist the data. Okay, but there's a second aspect of this that's just as important. Let's assume that you have extremely good data proving that dimethyl meatloaf can't cause leukemia. That's quite rare. But let's assume, you know that's rare, right? Usually the data we have is, you know, we've got some numbers down at the origin that says if you emit very little, it doesn't do any harm we can notice. And we've got some numbers up in the stratosphere that say if you emit a hell of a lot, people get sick. And in the middle, we have models, you know, and we fight with each other over whether it's concave or convex or linear, and, you know, whether there's a threshold and all the fights that regulators necessarily get into, because we haven't usually got good data in the middle. But I'm gonna pass all that by, and let's assume you have really good data to show that dimethyl meatloaf doesn't cause leukemia. Okay. Let's also assume that you're a really good speaker. That's also rare. Okay. And let's assume that they're a rational audience. That's also rare, but no rarer than the other two. So we're assuming optimal conditions. Okay. And under those optimal conditions, you know, it still takes you a couple of hours, but you succeed in convincing the room that it is impossible for dimethyl meatloaf to cause leukemia. Can't happen. The science proves that they've got to be wrong. Okay. And again, I emphasize, that's very hard to do. But let's assume you have done it. You pass out a multiple choice test, and they all get the question right. They really have learned that dimethyl meatloaf doesn't cause leukemia. During the several hours it took you to convince this room full of outraged people that dimethyl meatloaf does not cause leukemia, what has happened to their outrage? Has it gone down? Has it perhaps even gone up? What happens to people's outrage when you prove that they're wrong? Which way does it go? It goes up. So a very predictable thing happens. You get about 20 seconds of silence while everybody regroups emotionally, and then someone stands up in the back of the room and says, well, maybe you're right. Maybe dimethyl meatloaf can't cause leukemia, but I'll bet it causes birth defects. Okay. And you're right back where you started. Okay. Outrage is labile, to use the psychiatric term. It's fungible, to use the economic term. It's hard to separate outrage from the hazard it is attached to. But if you succeed in separating it from the hazard it's attached to, and you get free-floating outrage, like some kind of chemical radical, the free-floating outrage will migrate to another hazard and bond with that other hazard, and you're right back where you started. So I'm making two points. It's very hard to use data to convince people that they're wrong. Normally, when you use data, people become more outraged rather than less and more committed to their hypothesis about the hazard than they were in the beginning. But if you succeed in convincing them they're wrong without doing anything about their outrage, they'll simply reattach their outrage to some other hazard that is your, you know, that's in your portfolio, and you're right back where you started. So it's hard to do, and it's pretty close to useless to do. Before I move on, I want to emphasize that this is true of all of us. So I want to take it out of the professional context and bring it home. I would like you to imagine that you and your spouse, or if you're not married, you and someone you hang out with a lot, are having a quarrel over where to have dinner tonight. Shall we go out for Chinese food, or shall we go out for Italian food? And let's assume for whatever reason that the quarrel has gotten out of hand, and each of you thinks the other is acting like a real jerk. Is this a credible scenario so far? Okay. Given this scenario, raise your hand if you have found that a good way to deal with the situation, a good way to save the evening, is to present to your spouse data. Data about, I don't know, the relative nutritional merits of Chinese and Italian food. Prove to your spouse that you're right, and your spouse is the one who's a jerk, and then we'll have a pleasant evening. Okay. Raise your hand if that works in your household. Okay. No hands. If you don't learn that in your first marriage, you'll learn it in your second marriage. Yeah. Engineers, sometimes it takes three. But we all eventually learn that in a fight with somebody with whom you are involved in a serious relationship, in any fight in a serious relationship, the fight is always about the relationship. The substantive issue is ammunition you're throwing at each other. And under those circumstances, proving that you're right about the substantive issue does not nurture the relationship. Acknowledging that you're wrong about the substantive issue might very well nurture the relationship, but proving that you're right does not. So the same two things are true in this fight about where to have dinner tonight as were true in our dimethyl meatloaf meeting. Okay? Your spouse is going to resist the data that you are right and your spouse is wrong. But if your spouse acquires that data, if you have a rational spouse and really good data, and you know, you Google Chinese food and you Google Italian food and you force your spouse to sit down and read that you're right about whatever virtue you attach to the kind of food you prefer, and you win the argument, your spouse is almost sure to pick a fight about something else later in the evening. Because all you've done is detach the outrage from the hazard it was attached to, and it floats off to another hazard, and you're right back where you started. There are people who think that my model that says outrage trumps hazard in determining hazard perception, there are people who think it's brilliant. There are people who think it's crazy. And I deny both claims. I mean, my assertion would be we all know that already at home. We know it already in our dealings with our colleagues. We forget it when we're dealing with the public. Somehow it's not a spouse, it's not a teenage child, it's not a member of your family, it's not someone in your office, it's some community group. Okay. And suddenly we imagine that the way to calm them down if they're upset is to prove to them that they're being idiots. Okay. As if that ever worked at home.